officer and granted permanent tenure. The assurance of his promotion came a few weeks after his book was accepted. Upon that assurance, Edith announced that she and the baby would spend a week in St. Louis visiting her parents. She returned to Columbia in less than a week, harried and tired, but quietly triumphant. She had cut her visit short because the strain of caring for an infant had been too much for her mother, and the trip had so tired her that she was unable to care for Grace herself. But she had accomplished something. She drew from her bag a sheaf of papers and handed a small slip to William. It was a check for $6,000 made out to Mr. and Mrs. William Stoner, and signed with the bold, nearly illegible scrawl of Horace Bostwick.
"What's this?" Stoner asked.
She handed him the other papers. "It's a loan," she said. "All you have to do is sign these. I already have."
"But $6,000? What's it for?"
"A house," Edith said. "A real house of our own."
William Stoner looked again at the papers, shuffled through them quickly, and said,
"Edith, we can't. I'm sorry, but, look, I'll only be making $1,600 next year. The payments on this will be more than $60 a month. That's almost half my salary. And there will be taxes and insurance, and I just don't see how we can do it. I wish you had talked to me."
Her face became sorrowful. She turned away from him.
"I wanted to surprise you. I'm able to do so little, and I could do this."
He protested that he was grateful, but Edith would not be consoled.
"I was thinking of you and the baby," she said. "You could have a study, and Grace could have a yard to play in."
"I know," William said. "Maybe in a few years."
"In a few years," Edith repeated.
There was a silence. Then she said dully,
"I can't live like this. Not any longer. In an apartment. No matter where I go, I can hear you and hear the baby and the smell. I can't stand the smell. Day after day, the smell of diapers, and I can't stand it, and I can't get away from it. Don't you know? Don't you know?"
In the end, they accepted the money. Stoner decided that he could give up to teaching the summers he had promised himself for study and writing, at least for a few years. Edith took it upon herself to look for the house. Throughout the late spring and early summer, she was tireless in her search, which seemed to work an immediate cure of her illness. As soon as William came home from his classes, she went out and often did not return until dusk. Sometimes she walked, and sometimes she drove around with Caroline Finch, with whom she had become casually friendly. Late in June, she discovered the house she wanted. She signed an option to buy and agreed to take possession by the middle of August. It was an old two-storied house, only a few blocks from the campus. Its previous owners had allowed it to run down. The dark green paint was peeling from the boards, and the lawn was brown and infested with weeds. But the yard was large, and the house was roomy. It had a bedraggled grandeur that Edith could imagine renewed. She borrowed another $500 from her father for furniture, and in the time between the summer session and the beginning of the fall semester, William repainted the house. Edith wanted it white, and he had to put three coats on so that the dark green would not show through. Suddenly, in the first week of September, Edith decided that she wanted a party, a housewarming, she called it. She made the announcement with some resolution, as if it were a new beginning. They invited all those members of the department who had returned from their summer vacations, as well as a few town acquaintances of Edith. Hollis Lomax surprised everyone by accepting the invitation, the first he had accepted since his arrival in Columbia a year earlier. Stoner found a bootlegger and bought several bottles of gin. Gordon Finch promised to bring some beer, and Edith's Aunt Emma contributed two bottles of old sherry for those who would not drink hard liquor. Edith was reluctant to serve liquor at all. It was technically illegal to do so, But Caroline Finch intimated that no one at the university would think it really improper, and so she was persuaded. Fall came early that year. A light snow fell on the 10th of September, the day before registration. During the night a hard freeze gripped the land. By the end of the week, the time of the party, the cold weather had lifted, so that there was only a chill in the air. But the trees were leafless, the grass was beginning to brown, and there was a general bareness that presaged a hard winter. By the chill weather outside, by the stripped poplars and elms that stood starkly in their yard, and by the warmth and the ranked implements of the impending party inside, William Stoner was reminded of another day. For some time he could not decide what he was trying to remember. Then he realized that it was on such a day, almost 7 years before, that he had gone to Josiah Claremont's house and had seen Edith for the first time. It seemed far away to him and long ago. He could not reckon the changes that these few years had wrought. For nearly the whole week before the party, Edith lost herself in a frenzy of preparation. She hired a Negro girl for a week to help with the preparations and to serve, and the two of them scrubbed the floors and the walls, waxed the wood, dusted and cleaned the furniture, arranged it and rearranged it, so that on the night of the party Edith was in a state of near exhaustion. There were dark hollows under her eyes, and her voice was on the quiet edge of hysteria. At 6 o'clock, the guests were supposed to arrive at 7, she counted the glasses once again and discovered that she did not have enough for the guests expected. She broke into tears, rushed upstairs, sobbing that she didn't care what happened, she wasn't coming back down. Stoner tried to reassure her, but she would not answer him. He told her not to worry, that he would get the glasses. He told the maid that he would return soon and hurried out of the house. For nearly an hour he searched for a store still open where he could purchase glasses. By the time he found one, selected the glasses, and returned to the house, it was well after 7, and the first guests had arrived. Edith was among them in the living room, smiling and chatting as if she had no care or apprehension. She greeted William casually and told him to take the package into the kitchen. The party was like many another. Conversation began desultorily, gathered a swift but feeble energy, and trailed irrelevantly into other conversations. Laughter was quick and nervous, and it burst like tiny explosives in a continuous but unrelated barrage all over the room, and the members of the party flowed casually from one place to another, as if quietly occupying shifting positions of strategy. A few of them, like spies, wandered through the house, led by either Edith or William, and commented upon the superiority of such older houses as this over the new flimsier structures going up here and there on the outskirts of town. By 10 o'clock, most of the guests had taken plates, piled with sliced cold ham and turkey, pickled apricots, and the varied garniture of tiny tomatoes, celery stalks, olives, pickles, crisp radishes, and little raw cauliflower ears. A few were drunk and would not eat. By 11, most of the guests had gone. Among those who remained were Gordon and Caroline Finch, a few members of the department, whom Stoner had known for several years, and Hollis Lomax. Lomax was quite drunk, though not ostentatiously so. He walked carefully, as if he carried a burden over uneven terrain, and his thin, pale face shone through a film of sweat. The liquor loosened his tongue, and though he spoke precisely, his voice lost its edge of irony, and he appeared without defenses. He spoke of the loneliness of his childhood in Ohio, where his father had been a fairly successful small businessman. He told, as if of another person, of the isolation that his deformity had forced upon him, of the early shame which had no source that he could understand and no defense that he could muster. And when he told of the long days and evenings he had spent alone in his room, reading, to escape the limitations that his twisted body imposed upon him, and finding gradually a sense of freedom that grew more intense as he came to understand the nature of that freedom, when he told of this, William Stoner felt a kinship that he had not suspected. He knew that Lomax had gone through a kind of conversion, an epiphany of knowing something through words that could not be put in words, as Stoner himself had once done, in the class taught by Archer Sloane. Lomax had come to it early and alone, so that the knowledge was more nearly a part of himself than it was a part of Stoner. But in the way that was finally most important, the two men were alike, though neither of them might wish to admit it to the other, or even to himself. They talked till nearly 4 in the morning, and though they drank more, their talk grew quieter and quieter, until at last no one spoke at all. They sat close together amid the debris of the party, as if on an island, huddling together for warmth and assurance. After a while, Gordon and Caroline Finch got up and offered to drive Lomax to his rooms. Lomax shook Stoner's hand, asked him about his book, and wished him success with it. He walked over to Edith, who was sitting erect on a straight chair, and took her hand. He thanked her for the party. Then, as if on a quiet impulse, he bent a little and touched his lips to hers. Edith's hand came up lightly to his hair, and they remained so for several moments while the others looked on. It was the chastest kiss Stoner had ever seen, and it seemed perfectly natural. Stoner saw his guests out the front door and lingered a few moments, watching them descend the steps and walk out of the light from the porch. The cold air settled around him and clung. He breathed deeply, and the sharp coldness invigorated him. He closed the door reluctantly and turned. The living room was empty. Edith had already gone upstairs. He turned the lights off and made his way across the cluttered room to the stairs. Already the house was becoming familiar to him. He grasped a balustrade he could not see, and let himself be guided upward. When he got to the top of the stairs, he could see his way, for the hall was illumined by the light from the half-opened door of the bedroom. The boards creaked as he walked down the hall and went into the bedroom. Edith's clothes were flung in disarray on the floor beside the bed, the covers of which had been thrown back carelessly. She lay naked and glistening under the light, on the white unwrinkled sheet. Her body was lax and wanton in its naked sprawl, and it shone like pale gold. William came nearer the bed. She was fast asleep, but in a trick of the light her slightly opened mouth seemed to shape the soundless words of passion and love. He stood looking at her for a long time. He felt a distant pity and reluctant friendship and familiar respect. And he felt also a weary sadness, for he knew that no longer could the sight of her bring upon him the agony of desire that he had once known, and knew that he would never again be moved as he had once been moved by her presence. The sadness lessened, and he covered her gently, turned out the light, and got in bed beside her. The next morning Edith was ill and tired, and she spent the day in her room. William cleaned the house and attended to his daughter. On Monday he saw Lomax and spoke to him with a warmth that trailed from the night of the party. Lomax answered him with an irony that was like cold anger, and did not speak of the party that day or thereafter. It was as if he had discovered an enmity to hold him apart from Stoner, and he would not let it go. As William had feared, the house soon proved to be an almost destructive financial burden. Though he allocated his salary with some care, the end of the month found him always without funds, and each month he reduced the steadily dwindling reserve made by his summer teaching. The first year they owned the house, he missed 2 payments to Edith's father, and he received a frosty and principled letter of advice upon sound financial planning. Nevertheless, he began to feel a joy in property, and to know a comfort that he had not anticipated. His study was on the first floor off the living room, with a high north window. In the daytime the room was softly illumined, and the wood paneling glowed with the richness of age. He found in the cellar a quantity of boards, which, beneath the ravages of dirt and mold, matched the paneling of the room. He refinished these boards and constructed bookcases, so that he might be surrounded by his books. At a used furniture store he found some dilapidated chairs, a couch, and an ancient desk, for which he paid a few dollars, and which he spent many weeks repairing. As he worked on the room, and as it began slowly to take a shape, he realized that for many years, unknown to himself, he had had an image locked somewhere within him, like a shamed secret, an image that was ostensibly of a place, but which was actually of himself. So it was himself that he was attempting to define as he worked on his study. As he sanded the old boards for his bookcases and saw the surface roughnesses disappear, the gray weathering flake away to the essential wood, and finally to a rich purity of grain and texture, as he repaired his furniture and arranged it in the room, it was himself that he was slowly shaping. It was himself that he was putting into a kind of order. It was himself that he was making possible. Thus, despite the regularly recurring pressures of debt and need, the next few years were happy, and he lived much as he had dreamed that he might live when he was a young student in graduate school, and when he had first married. Edith did not partake of so large a part of his life as he had once hoped. Indeed, it seemed that they had entered into a long truce that was like a stalemate. They spent most of their lives apart. Edith kept the house, which seldom had visitors, in spotless condition. When she was not sweeping or dusting or washing or polishing, she stayed in her room and seemed content to do so. She never entered William's study. It was as if it did not exist to her. William still had most of the care of their daughter. In the afternoons, when he came home from the university, he took Grace from the upstairs bedroom that he had converted into a nursery and let her play in the study while he worked. She played quietly and contentedly on the floor, satisfied to be alone. Every now and then William spoke to her, and she paused to look at him in solemn and slow delight. Sometimes he asked students to drop by for conferences and chats. He brewed tea for them on a little hot plate that he kept beside his desk, and felt an awkward fondness for them as they sat self-consciously on the chairs, remarked upon his library, and complimented him on the beauty of his daughter. He apologized for the absence of his wife and explained her illness, until at last he realized that his repetitions of apology were stressing her absence rather than accounting for it. He said no more, and hoped that his silence was less compromising than were his explanations. Except for Edith's absence from it, his life was nearly what he wanted it to be. He studied and wrote when he was not preparing for class or grading papers or reading theses. He hoped in time to make a reputation for himself as both a scholar and a teacher. His expectations for his first book had been both cautious and modest, and they had been appropriate. One reviewer had called it pedestrian, and another had called it a competent survey. At first he had been very proud of the book. He had held it in his hands and caressed its plain wrapper and turned its pages. It seemed delicate and alive, like a child. He had reread it in print, mildly surprised that it was neither better nor worse than he had thought it would be. After a while he tired of seeing it, but he never thought of it and his authorship without a sense of wonder and disbelief at his own temerity and at the responsibility he had assumed. Chapter 7. One evening in the spring of 1927, William Stoner came home late. The scent of budding flowers mingled and hung in the moist, warm air. Crickets hummed in the shadows. In the distance, a lone automobile raised dust and sent into the stillness a loud, defiant clatter. He walked slowly, caught in the somnolence of a new season, bemused by the tiny green buds that glowed out of the shade of bush and tree. When he went into the house, Edith was at the far end of the living room, holding the telephone receiver to her ear and looking at him.
"You're late," she said.
"Yes," he said pleasantly. "We had doctor's orals." She handed him the receiver.
"It's for you, long distance. Someone's been trying to get you all afternoon. I told them you were at the university, but they've been calling back here every hour."
William took the receiver and spoke into the mouthpiece. No one answered.
"Hello?" he said again.
The thin, strange voice of a man answered him.
"This Bill Stoner?"
"Yes, who is this?"
"You don't know me. I was passing by, and your ma asked me to call. I've been trying all afternoon."
"Yes," Stoner said. His hand holding the mouthpiece was shaking. "What's wrong?"
"It's your pa," the voice said. "I don't rightly know how to start."
The dry, laconic, frightened voice went on, and William Stoner listened to it dully, as if it had no existence beyond the receiver that he held to his ear. What he heard concerned his father. He had been, the voice said, feeling poorly for nearly a week, and because his field hand by himself had not been able to keep up with the furrowing and planting, and even though he had a high fever, he had started out early in the morning to get some planting done. His field hand had found him at mid-morning, lying face down on the broken field, unconscious. He had carried him to the house, put him in bed, and gone to fetch a doctor, but by noon he was dead.
"Thank you for calling," Stoner said mechanically. "Tell my mother that I'll be there tomorrow."
He put the receiver back on its hook and stared for a long time at the bell-shaped mouthpiece attached to the narrow black cylinder. He turned around and looked at the room. Edith was regarding him expectantly.
"Well, what is it?" she asked.
"It's my father," Stoner said. "He's dead."
"Oh, Willie," Edith said.
Then she nodded. "You'll probably be gone for the rest of the week, then."
"Yes," Stoner said.
"Then I'll get Aunt Emma to come over and help with Grace."
"Yes," Stoner said mechanically.
"Yes." He got someone to take his classes for the rest of the week, and early the next morning caught the bus for Boonville. The highway from Columbia to Kansas City, which cut through Boonville, was the one that he had traveled 17 years before, when he had first come to the university. Now it was wide and paved, and neat straight fences enclosed fields of wheat and corn that flashed by him outside the bus window. Boonville had changed little during the years he had not seen it. A few new buildings had gone up, a few old ones had been torn down, but the town retained its bareness and flimsiness, and looked still as if it were only a temporary arrangement that could be dispensed with at any moment. Though most of the streets had been paved in the last few years, a thin haze of dust hung about the town, and a few horse-drawn, steel-tired wagons were still around, the wheels sometimes giving off sparks as they scraped against the concrete paving of street and curb. Nor had the house changed substantially. It was perhaps drier and grayer than it had been. Not even a fleck of paint remained on the clapboards, and the unpainted timber of the porch sagged a bit nearer to the bare earth. There were some people in the house, neighbors whom Stoner did not remember. A tall, gaunt man in a black suit, white shirt, and string tie was bending over his mother, who sat in a straight chair beside the narrow wooden box that held the body of his father. Stoner started across the room. The tall man saw him and walked to meet him. The man's eyes were gray and flat, like pieces of glazed crockery. A deep and unctuous baritone voice, hushed and thick, uttered some words. The man called Stoner brother, and spoke of bereavement,
and God who hath taken away, and wanted to know if Stoner wished to pray with him. Stoner brushed past the man and stood in front of his mother. Her face swam before him. Through a blur he saw her nod to him and get up from the chair. She took his arm and said, "You'll want to see your pa." With a touch that was so frail that he could hardly feel it, she led him beside the open coffin. He looked down. He looked until his eyes cleared, and then he started back in shock. The body that he saw seemed that of a stranger. It was shrunken and tiny, and its face was like a thin brown paper mask, with black deep depressions where the eyes should have been. The dark blue suit which enfolded the body was grotesquely large, and the hands that folded out of the sleeves over the chest were like the dried claws of an animal. Stoner turned to his mother, and he knew that the horror he felt was in his eyes. "Your pa lost a lot of weight the last week or two," she said. "I asked him not to go out in the field, but he got up before I was awake and was gone. He was out of his head. He was just so sick he was out of his head and didn't know what he was doing. The doctor said he must have been, or he couldn't have managed it." As she spoke, Stoner saw her clearly. It was as if she, too, were dead as she spoke, a part of her gone irretrievably into that box with her husband, not to emerge again. He saw her now. Her face was thin and shrunken. Even in repose it was so drawn that the tips of her teeth were disclosed beneath her thin lips. She walked as if she had no weight or strength. He muttered a word and left the parlor. He went to the room in which he had grown up and stood in its bareness. His eyes were hot and dry, and he could not weep. He made the arrangements that had to be made for the funeral, and signed the papers that needed to be signed. Like all country folk, his parents had burial policies, toward which for most of their lives they had set aside a few pennies each week, even during the times of most desperate need. There was something pitiful about the policies that his mother got from an old trunk in her bedroom. The gilt from the elaborate printing was beginning to fleck away, and the cheap paper was brittle with age. He talked to his mother about the future. He wanted her to return with him to Columbia. There was plenty of room, he said, and, he twinged at the lie, Edith would welcome her company. But his mother would not return with him. "I wouldn't feel right," she said. "Your pa and I've lived here nearly all my life. I just don't think I could settle anywhere else and feel right about it. And besides, Tobe..." Stoner remembered that Tobe was the Negro field hand his father had hired many years ago. "Tobe has said he'd stay on here as long as I need him. He's got a nice room fixed up in the cellar. We'll be all right." Stoner argued with her, but she would not be moved. At last he realized that she wished only to die, and wished to do so where she had lived. And he knew that she deserved the little dignity she could find in doing as she wanted to do. They buried his father in a small plot on the outskirts of Boonville, and William returned to the farm with his mother. That night he could not sleep. He dressed and walked into the field that his father had worked year after year, to the end that he now had found. He tried to remember his father, but the face that he had known in his youth would not come to him. He knelt in the field and took a dry clod of earth in his hand. He broke it and watched the grains, dark in the moonlight, crumble and flow through his fingers. He brushed his hand on his trouser leg and got up, and went back to the house. He did not sleep. He lay on the bed and looked out the single window until the dawn came, until there were no shadows upon the land, until it stretched gray and barren and infinite before him. After the death of his father, Stoner made weekend trips to the farm as often as he could, and each time he saw his mother, he saw her grown thinner and paler and stiller, until at last it seemed that only her sunken bright eyes were alive.
During her last days, she did not speak to him at all. Her eyes flickered faintly as she stared up from her bed, and occasionally a small sigh came from her lips. He buried her beside her husband. After the services were over and the few mourners had gone, he stood alone in a cold November wind and looked at the two graves, one open to its burden and the other mounded and covered by a thin fuzz of grass. He turned on the bare, treeless little plot that held others like his mother and father, and looked across the flat land in the direction of the farm where he had been born, where his mother and father had spent their years. He thought of the cost exacted year after year by the soil, and it remained as it had been, a little more barren, perhaps, a little more frugal of increase. Nothing had changed. Their lives had been expended in cheerless labor, their wills broken, their intelligences numbed. Now they were in the earth to which they had given their lives, and slowly, year by year, the earth would take them. Slowly the damp and rot would infest the pine boxes which held their bodies, and slowly it would touch their flesh, and finally it would consume the last vestiges of their substances, and they would become a meaningless part of that stubborn earth to which they had long ago given themselves. He let Tobe stay on at the farm through the winter. In the spring of 1928 he put the farm up for sale. The understanding was that Tobe was to remain on the farm until it was sold, and whatever he raised would belong to him. Tobe fixed the place up as best he could, repairing the house and repainting the small barn. Even so, it was not until early in the spring of 1929 that Stoner found a suitable buyer. He accepted the first offer he received, of a little over $2,000. He gave Tobe a few $100s, and in late August sent the rest of it to his father-in-law, to reduce the amount owed on the house in Columbia. In October of that year, the stock market failed, and local newspapers carried stories about Wall Street, about fortunes ruined and great lives altered. Few people in Columbia were touched. It was a conservative community, and almost none of the townspeople had money in stocks or bonds. But news began to come in of bank failures across the country, and the beginnings of uncertainty touched some of the townspeople. A few farmers withdrew their savings, and a few more, urged by the local bankers, increased their deposits. But no one was really apprehensive until word came of the failure of a small private bank, the Merchants' Trust in St. Louis. Stoner was at lunch in the university cafeteria when the news came, and he immediately went home to tell Edith. The Merchants' Trust was the bank that held the mortgage on their home, and the bank of which Edith's father was president. Edith called St. Louis that afternoon and talked to her mother. Her mother was cheerful, and she told Edith that Mr. Bostwick had assured her that there was nothing to worry about, that everything would be all right in a few weeks. 3 days after that, Horace Bostwick was dead. A suicide. He went to his office at the bank one morning in an unusually cheerful mood. He greeted several of the bank employees, who still worked behind the closed doors of the bank, went into his office, after telling his secretary that he would receive no calls, and locked his door. At about 10 o'clock in the morning, he shot himself in the head with a revolver he had purchased the day before and brought with him in his briefcase. He left no note behind him, but the papers, neatly arranged on his desk, told all that he had to tell. And what he had to tell was simply financial ruin. Like his Bostonian father, he had invested unwisely, not only his own money but also the bank's. And his ruin was so complete that he could imagine no relief. As it turned out, the ruin was not so nearly total as he thought at the moment of his suicide. After the estate was settled, the family house remained intact, and some minor real estate on the outskirts of St. Louis was sufficient to furnish his wife with a small income for the rest of her life. But this was not known immediately.
William Stoner received the telephone call that informed him of Horace Bostwick's ruin and suicide, and he broke the news to Edith, as gently as his estrangement from her would allow him. Edith took the news calmly, almost as if she had been expecting it. She looked at Stoner for several moments without speaking, then she shook her head and said absently, "Poor mother, what will she do? There's always been someone to take care of her. How will she live?" Stoner said, "Tell her," he paused awkwardly, "tell her that if she wants to, she can come live with us. She will be welcome." Edith smiled at him with a curious mixture of fondness and contempt. "Oh, Willie, she'd rather die herself. Don't you know that?" Stoner nodded. "I suppose I do," he said. So on the evening of the day that Stoner received the call, Edith left Columbia to go to St. Louis for the funeral and to stay there as long as she was needed. When she had been gone a week, Stoner received a brief note informing him that she would remain with her mother for another 2 weeks, perhaps longer. She was gone for nearly 2 months, and William was alone in the big house with his daughter. For the first few days, the emptiness of the house was strangely and unexpectedly disquieting, but he got used to the emptiness and began to enjoy it. Within a week, he knew himself to be as happy as he had been in years, and when he thought of Edith's inevitable return, it was with a quiet regret that he no longer needed to hide from himself. Grace had had her 6th birthday in the spring of that year, and she started her first year of school that fall. Every morning Stoner got her ready for school, and he was back from the university in the afternoon in time to greet her when she came home. At the age of 6, Grace was a tall, slender child, with hair that was more blonde than red. Her skin was perfectly fair, and her eyes were dark blue, almost violet. She was quiet and cheerful, and she had a delight in things that gave her father a feeling that was like nostalgic reverence. Sometimes Grace played with neighbor children, but more often she sat with her father in his large study and watched him as he graded papers or read or wrote. She spoke to him, and they conversed, so quietly and seriously that William Stoner was moved by a tenderness that he never foresaw. Grace drew awkward and charming pictures on sheets of yellow paper and presented them solemnly to her father, or she read aloud to him from her first-grade reader. At night, when Stoner put her to bed and returned to his study, he was aware of her absence from his room and was comforted by the knowledge that she slept securely above him. In ways of which he was barely conscious, he started her education, and he watched with amazement and love as she grew before him, and as her face began to show the intelligence that worked within her. Edith did not return to Columbia until after the first of the year, so William Stoner and his daughter spent Christmas by themselves. On Christmas morning they exchanged gifts. For her father, who did not smoke, Grace had modeled at the cautiously progressive school attached to the university a crude ashtray. William gave her a new dress that he had selected himself at a downtown store, several books, and a coloring set. They sat most of the day before the small tree, talked and watched the lights twinkle on the ornaments and the tinsel wink from the dark green fur like buried fire. During the Christmas holiday, that curious suspended pause in the rushing semester, William Stoner began to realize 2 things. He began to know how centrally important Grace had become to his existence, and he began to understand that it might be possible for him to become a good teacher. He was ready to admit to himself that he had not been a good teacher. Always, from the time he had fumbled through his first classes of freshman English, he had been aware of the gulf that lay between what he felt for his subject and what he delivered in the classroom. He had hoped that time and experience would repair the gulf, but they had not done so. Those things that he held most deeply were most profoundly betrayed when he spoke of them to his classes. what was most alive withered in his words, and what moved him most became cold in its utterance. And the consciousness of his inadequacy distressed him so greatly that the sense of it grew habitual, as much a part of him as the stoop of his shoulders. But during the weeks that Edith was in St. Louis, when he lectured, he now and then found himself so lost in his subject that he became forgetful of his inadequacy, of himself, and even of the students before him. Now and then he became so caught by his enthusiasm that he stuttered, gesticulated, and ignored the lecture notes that usually guided his talks. At first he was disturbed by his outbursts, as if he presumed too familiarly upon his subject, and he apologized to his students. But when they began coming up to him after class, and when in their papers they began to show hints of imagination and the revelation of a tentative love, he was encouraged to do what he had never been taught to do. The love of literature, of language, of the mystery of the mind and heart showing themselves in the minute, strange, and unexpected combinations of letters and words, in the blackest and coldest print, the love which he had hidden as if it were illicit and dangerous, he began to display, tentatively at first, and then boldly, and then proudly. He was both saddened and heartened by his discovery of what he might do. Beyond his intention, he felt he had cheated both his students and himself. The students who had been able theretofore to plod through his courses by the repetition of mechanical steps began to look at him with puzzlement and resentment. Those who had not taken courses from him began to sit in on his lectures and nod to him in the halls. He spoke more confidently and felt a warm, hard severity gather within him. He suspected that he was beginning, 10 years late, to discover who he was, and the figure he saw was both more and less than he had once imagined it to be. He felt himself at last beginning to be a teacher, which was simply a man to whom his book is true, to whom is given a dignity of art that has little to do with his foolishness or weakness or inadequacy as a man. It was a knowledge of which he could not speak, but one which changed him once he had it, so that no one could mistake its presence. Thus, when Edith came back from St. Louis, she found him changed in a way that she could not understand, but of which she was instantly aware. She returned without warning on an afternoon train, and walked through the living room into the study where her husband and her daughter quietly sat. She had meant to shock them both by her sudden presence and by her changed appearance, but when William looked up at her, and she saw the surprise in his eyes, she knew at once that the real change had come over him, and that it was so deep that the effect of her appearance was lost. And she thought to herself, a little distantly, and yet with some surprise, "I know him better than I ever realized." William was surprised at her presence and her altered appearance, but neither could move him now as they might once have done. He looked at her for several moments, and then got up from his desk, went across the room, and greeted her gravely. Edith had bobbed her hair, and wore over it one of those hats that hugged her head so tightly that the cropped hair lay close to her face like an irregular frame. Her lips were painted a bright orange-red, and 2 small spots of rouge sharpened her cheekbones. She wore one of those short dresses that had become fashionable among the younger women during the past few years. It hung straight down from her shoulders and ended just above her knees. She smiled self-consciously at her husband and walked across the room to her daughter, who sat on the floor and looked up at her quietly and studiously. She knelt awkwardly, her new dress tight around her legs.
"Gracie, honey," she said in a voice that seemed to William to be strained and brittle, "did you miss your mommy? Did you think she was never coming back?"
Grace kissed her mother on the cheek and looked at her solemnly.
"You look different," she said.
Edith laughed and got up from the floor. She whirled around, holding her hands above her head. "I have a new dress and new shoes and a new hairdo. Do you like them?"
Grace nodded dubiously.
"You look different," she said again.
Edith's smile widened. There was a pale smear of lipstick on one of her teeth. She turned to William and asked,
"Do I look different?"
"Yes," William said. "Very charming. Very pretty." She laughed at him and shook her head.
"Poor Willie," she said.
Then she turned again to her daughter.
"I am different, I believe," she said to her. "I really believe I am."
But William Stoner knew that she was speaking to him, and at that moment, somehow, he also knew that beyond her intention or understanding, unknown to herself, Edith was trying to announce to him a new declaration of war. Chapter 8 The declaration was a part of the change that Edith had started bringing about during the week she had spent at home in St. Louis after her father's death. And it was intensified and finally given point and savagery by that other change that came and slowly grew upon William Stoner after he discovered that he might become a good teacher. Edith had been curiously unmoved at her father's funeral. During the elaborate ceremonies, she sat erect and hard-faced, and her expression did not alter when she had to go past her father's body, resplendent and plump, in the ornate coffin. But at the cemetery, when the coffin was lowered into the narrow hole masked by mats of artificial grass, she lowered her expressionless face into her hands and did not raise it until someone touched her shoulder. After the funeral, she spent several days in her old room, the room in which she had grown up. She saw her mother only at breakfast and at dinner. It was thought by callers that she was secluded in her grief. "They were very close," Edith's mother said mysteriously, "much closer than they seemed." But in that room, Edith walked about as if for the first time, freely, touching the walls and windows, testing their solidity. She had a trunk full of her childhood belongings brought down from the attic. She went through her bureau drawers, which had remained undisturbed for more than a decade. With a bemused air of leisure, as if she had all the time in the world, she went through her things, fondling them, turning them this way and that, examining them with an almost ritualistic care. When she came upon a letter she had received as a child, she read it through from beginning to end as if for the first time. When she came upon a forgotten doll, she smiled at it and caressed the painted bisque of its cheek as if she were a child again who had received a gift. Finally, she arranged all of her childhood belongings neatly in two piles. One of these consisted of toys and trinkets she had acquired for herself, of secret photographs and letters from school friends, of gifts she had at one time received from distant relatives. The other pile consisted of those things that her father had given her, and of things with which he had been directly or indirectly connected. It was to this pile that she gave her attention. Methodically, expressionlessly, with neither anger nor joy, she took the objects there one by one and destroyed them. The letters and clothes, the stuffing from the dolls, the pincushions and pictures, she burned in the fireplace. The clay and porcelain heads, the hands and arms and feet of the dolls, she pounded to a fine powder on the hearth. And what remained after the burning and pounding, she swept into a small pile and flushed down the toilet in the bathroom that adjoined her room. When the job was done, the room cleared of smoke, the hearth swept, the few remaining belongings returned to the chest of drawers, Edith Bostwick Stoner sat at her small dressing table and looked at herself in the mirror, the silver backing of which was thinning and flecking away, so that here and there her image was imperfectly reflected, or not reflected at all, giving her face a curiously incomplete look. She was 30 years old. The youthful gloss was beginning to fall from her hair, tiny lines were starting out from around her eyes, and the skin of her face was beginning to tighten around her sharp cheekbones.
She nodded to the image in the mirror, got up abruptly, and went downstairs, where for the first time in days she talked cheerfully and almost intimately to her mother. She wanted, she said, a change in herself. She had too long been what she was. She spoke of her childhood, of her marriage. And from sources that she could speak of but vaguely and uncertainly, she fixed an image that she wished to fulfill. And for nearly the whole of the 2 months that she stayed in St. Louis with her mother, she devoted herself to that fulfillment. She asked to borrow a sum of money from her mother, who made her an impetuous gift of it. She bought a new wardrobe, burning all the clothes she had brought with her from Columbia. She had her hair cut short and fashioned in the mode of the day. She bought cosmetics and perfumes, the use of which she practiced daily in her room. She learned to smoke, and she cultivated a new way of speaking, which was brittle, vaguely English, and a little shrill. She returned to Columbia with this outward change well under control, and with another change, secret and potential, within her. During the first few months after her return to Columbia, she was furious with activity. No longer did it seem necessary to pretend to herself that she was ill or weak. She joined a little theater group, and devoted herself to the work that was given her. She designed and painted sets, raised money for the group, and even had a few small parts in the productions. When Stoner came home in the afternoons, he found the living room filled with her friends, strangers who looked at him as if he were an intruder, to whom he nodded politely and retreated to his study, where he could hear their voices, muted and declamatory, beyond his walls. Edith purchased a used upright piano and had it put in the living room against the wall which separated that room from William's study. She had given up the practice of music shortly before her marriage, and she now started almost anew, practicing scales, laboring through exercises that were too difficult for her, playing sometimes 2 or 3 hours a day, often in the evening, after Grace had been put to bed. The groups of students whom Stoner invited to his study for conversation grew larger and the meetings more frequent, and no longer was Edith content to remain upstairs, away from the gatherings. She insisted upon serving them tea or coffee, and when she did, she seated herself in the room. She talked loudly and gaily, managing to turn the conversation toward her work in the little theater, or her music, or her painting and sculpture, which she announced she was planning to take up again as soon as she found time. The students, mystified and embarrassed, gradually stopped coming, and Stoner began meeting them for coffee in the university cafeteria, or in one of the small cafes scattered around the campus. He did not speak to Edith about her new behavior. Her activities caused him only minor annoyance, and she seemed happy, though perhaps a bit desperately so. It was finally himself that he held responsible for the new direction her life had taken. He had been unable to discover for her any meaning in their life together, in their marriage. Thus it was right for her to take what meaning she could find in areas that had nothing to do with him, and go ways he could not follow. Emboldened by his new success as a teacher, and by his growing popularity among the better graduate students, he started a new book in the summer of 1930. He now spent nearly all of his free time in his study. He and Edith kept up between themselves the pretense of sharing the same bedroom, but he seldom entered that room, and never at night. He slept on his studio couch, and even kept his clothes in a small closet he constructed in one corner of the room. He was able to be with Grace. As had become her habit during her mother's first long absence, she spent much of her time with her father in his study. Stoner even found a small desk and chair for her, so that she had a place to read and do her homework. They had their meals more often than not alone. Edith was away from the house a great deal, and when she was not away, she frequently entertained her theater friends at little parties which did not admit the presence of a child. Then, abruptly, Edith began staying home. The three of them started taking their meals together again. and Edith even made a few movements toward caring for the house. The house was quiet, even the piano was unused, so that dust gathered on the keyboard. They had come to that point in their life together when they seldom spoke of themselves or each other, lest the delicate balance that made their living together possible be broken. So it was only after long hesitation and deliberation about consequences that Stoner finally asked her if anything was wrong. They were at the dinner table. Grace had been excused and had taken a book into Stoner's study. "What do you mean?" Edith asked.
"Your friends," William said. "They haven't been around for some time, and you don't seem to be so involved with your theater work anymore. I was just wondering if there was anything wrong."
With an almost masculine gesture, Edith shook a cigarette from the package beside her plate, stuck it between her lips, and lighted it with the stub of another that she had half finished. She inhaled deeply without taking the cigarette from her lips, and tilted her head back so that when she looked at William, her eyes were narrowed and quizzical and calculating.
"Nothing's wrong," she said. "I just got bored with them and the work. Does there always have to be something wrong?"
"No," William said. "I just thought maybe you weren't feeling well or something."
He thought no more about the conversation, and shortly thereafter he left the table and went into the study, where Grace was sitting at her desk, immersed in her book. The desk light gleamed in her hair and threw her small, serious face into sharp outline. She has grown during the past year, William thought, and a small, not unpleasant sadness caught briefly at his throat. He smiled and went quietly to his desk. Within a few moments he was immersed in his work. The evening before he had caught up with the routine of his classwork, papers had been graded and lectures prepared for the whole week that was to follow. He saw the evening before him and several evenings more in which he would be free to work on his book. What he wanted to do in this new book was not yet precisely clear to him. In general, he wished to extend himself beyond his first study, in both time and scope. He wanted to work in the period of the English Renaissance, and to extend his study of classical and medieval Latin influences into that area. He was in the stage of planning his study, and it was that stage which gave him the most pleasure, the selection among alternative approaches, the rejection of certain strategies, the mysteries and uncertainties that lay in unexplored possibilities, the consequences of choice. The possibilities he could see so exhilarated him that he could not keep still. He got up from his desk, paced a little, and in a kind of frustrated joy spoke to his daughter, who looked up from her book and answered him. She caught his mood, and something he said caused her to laugh. Then the two of them were laughing together, senselessly, as if they both were children. Suddenly the door to the study came open, and the hard light from the living room streamed into the shadowed recesses of the study. Edith stood outlined in that light.
"Grace," she said distinctly and slowly, "your father is trying to work. You mustn't disturb him."
For several moments William and his daughter were so stunned by this sudden intrusion that neither of them moved or spoke. Then William managed to say, "It's all right, Edith. She doesn't bother me." As if he had not spoken, Edith said,
"Grace, did you hear me? Come out of there this instant."
Bewildered, Grace got down from her chair and walked across the room. In the center she paused, looking first at her father and then at her mother. Edith started to speak again, but William managed to cut her off.
"It's all right, Grace," he said as gently as he could. "It's all right. Go with your mother."
As Grace went through the study door to the living room, Edith said to her husband, "The child has had entirely too much freedom. It isn't natural for her to be so quiet, so withdrawn. She's been too much alone. She should be more active, play with children her own age. Don't you realize how unhappy she has been?" And she shut the door before he could answer. He did not move for a long while. He looked at his desk, littered with notes and open books. He walked slowly across the room and aimlessly rearranged the sheets of paper, the books. He stood there, frowning, for several minutes more, as if he were trying to remember something. Then he turned again and walked to Grace's small desk. He stood there for some time, as he had stood at his own desk. He turned off the lamp there, so that the desk top was gray and lifeless, and went across to the couch, where he lay with his eyes open, staring at the ceiling. The enormity came upon him gradually, so that it was several weeks before he could admit to himself what Edith was doing, and when he was able at last to make that admission, he made it almost without surprise. Edith's was a campaign waged with such cleverness and skill that he could find no rational grounds for complaint. After her abrupt and almost brutal entrance into his study that night, an entrance which in retrospect seemed to him a surprise attack, Edith's strategy became more indirect, more quiet and contained. It was a strategy that disguised itself as love and concern, and thus one against which he was helpless. Edith was at home nearly all the time now. During the morning and early afternoon, while Grace was at school, she occupied herself with redecorating Grace's bedroom. She removed the small desk from Stoner's study, refinished and repainted it a pale pink, attaching around the top a broad ribbon of matching ruffled satin, so that it bore no resemblance to the desk Grace had grown used to. One afternoon, with Grace standing mutely beside her, she went through all the clothing William had bought for her, discarded most of it, and promised Grace that they would this weekend go downtown and replace the discarded items with things more fitting, something girlish. And they did. Late in the afternoon, weary but triumphant, Edith returned with a load of packages and an exhausted daughter, desperately uncomfortable in a new dress, stiff with starch and a myriad of ruffles, from beneath the ballooning hem of which her thin legs stuck out like pathetic sticks. Edith bought her daughter dolls and toys and hovered about her while she played with them, as if it were a duty. She started her on piano lessons and sat beside her on the bench as she practiced. Upon the slightest occasion she gave little parties for her, which neighborhood children attended, vindictive and sullen in their stiff formal clothing, and she strictly supervised her daughter's reading and homework, not allowing her to work beyond the time she had allotted. Now Edith's visitors were neighborhood mothers. They came in the mornings and drank coffee and talked while their children were in school. In the afternoons they brought their children with them and watched them playing games in the large living room, and talked aimlessly above the noise of games and running. On these afternoons, Stoner was usually in his study, and could hear what the mothers said as they spoke loudly across the room, above their children's voices. Once, when there was a lull in the noise, he heard Edith say, "Poor Grace. She's so fond of her father, but he has so little time to devote to her. His work, you know. And he has started a new book." Curiously, almost detachedly, he watched his hands, which had been holding a book, begin to shake. They shook for several moments before he brought them under control by jamming them deep in his pockets, clenching them and holding them there. He saw his daughter seldom now. The three of them took their meals together, but on these occasions he hardly dared to speak to her, for when he did, and when Grace answered him, Edith soon found something wanting in Grace's table manners, or in the way she sat in her chair, and she spoke so sharply that her daughter remained silent and downcast through the rest of the meal. Grace's already slender body was becoming thinner. Edith laughed gently about her growing up but not out. Her eyes were becoming watchful, almost wary. The expression that had once been quietly serene was now either faintly sullen at one extreme or gleeful and animated on the thin edge of hysteria at the other. She seldom smiled any more, although she laughed a great deal, and when she did smile, it was as if a ghost flitted across her face. Once, while Edith was upstairs, William and his daughter passed each other in the living room. Grace smiled shyly at him, and involuntarily he knelt on the floor and embraced her. He felt her body stiffen, and he saw her face go bewildered and afraid. He raised himself gently away from her, said something inconsequential, and retreated to his study. The morning after this, he stayed at the breakfast table until Grace left for school, even though he knew he would be